He spent most of these days of autumnal peace by working slavishly to improve his home. And when the Allercamps went into Fredericksburg on Saturdays, he spent much of his time playing with the neighbors' children and teaching them games, or serving as their four-legged horse down on his knees, while they galloped about the grass, lashing at his flanks with little twigs. Franziska, watching with pleasure as he gamboled with the children, wished that she could add to his pleasure by informing him that she was pregnant. But for the present, this was not to be. He had once told her, during their long talks when they were getting to know each other after their unusual marriage, that he had been driven to acquire the land at Fredericksburg, not only because of his intense love for her, but also because he had so treasured those evenings spent talking with Martin Ascott and Betsy Bell, that he had become determined to have a home of his own, where people could stop by and talk about what was happening. They did not as yet actually have such a home on their own land, that is, because it had been deemed prudent, in view of Otto's absences as a ranger, for everyone to delay building a McNab house on the McNab holdings. But during this unexpected reprieve from battle, they began collecting the field stones and slabs of limestone from which a true McNab home could one day be built. If the Germans had the materials, the manpower, and the determination to build Otto and Franziska a house, what deterred them? The Comanche. As soon as the Indians learned that the Texans were embroiled in a war with Mexico, with most white fighting men engaged below the Rio Grande, they moved daringly closer to all white settlements, so that there was a constant fear of new massacres, kidnappings, and burnings. It would be unthinkable to leave our daughter alone on a farm 2 or 3 miles away from our protection, Ludwig explained to Otto when the latter wanted to start building his own home. The Comanche are becoming bold and terrible. The Germans had acquired extra rifles and were teaching Thekla and Franziska to reload and fire the weapons, and no Allercamp man ever worked alone in a field. He either worked with another man or perched his woman on a stump to guard him with a loaded rifle while he labored. Ernst is different, Franziska explained to her husband one night, soon after his return, as they lay on their straw mattress bed. We didn't want to worry you, but he actually goes out among the Comanche. What? Otto sat bolt upright. Yes, he knows their language now. He talks with them. Why? He's trying to persuade them to make a lasting peace treaty with us Germans. He tells them we're different, that we can be trusted. Good God! Doesn't he know what happened at the San Antonio Council House? The massacre? He tells them that was not our fault, that with us Germans it could never happen. But what about Victoria? In his confusion, Otto rose from bed and stomped about the little room. The Comanche are our enemy. You didn't see my mother, my aunt. Franza, it was horrible. Ernst says it needn't be that way any longer. Not here, not with us Germans. I better talk with Ernst. And despite her protests at the lateness of the hour, he strode over to the other house and roused his brother-in-law, the one who called himself Uncas. I know all about the massacres, Otto, and I know how much you loved your two Mexican women. The Comanche are terrible, but the time comes when peace must be reached. With the Comanche, never. What's going on there? Ludwig's deep voice called, and when the two young men explained they were arguing about the Comanche, he growled, Argue outside and let honest people sleep. Wrapping themselves in blankets, they went out into the October stillness, and when Ernst saw the huge golden disk of the full moon, he said, Comanche moon, that's what they call it. It's on bright nights like this they make their attacks. And the two men looked into the shadows, half expecting to see the savages preparing for an assault on the Allercamp place. Do you honestly think that peace... Before Otto could finish his question, Ernst gripped his arm and said, I know that peace is possible with anyone, anyone. When your battles down there end, won't you have to arrange peace with the Mexicans? Of course. And we must arrange peace with the Comanche. In the days that followed, Franziska told her husband about an astonishing frontier drama centering upon a German immigrant whom Otto did not know. Otfried Hans, Freiherr von Mirsebach, was one of those admirable, inquisitive young noblemen whom the European countries occasionally produced. Born in a German duchy, educated in various German universities, he spoke five languages and seemed destined to follow his brother as a major diplomat, when he was dispatched to Texas to bolster the sagging German settlements in the area north of San Antonio. Instantly charmed by the democratic freedoms of his new country, he surrendered the honorific Freiherr, took an American name, and performed notably as John O. Mirsbach. As soon as he had arrived, he was visited by Ernst Ahlerkamp, who assured him, "I have worked with the Comanche for 2 years. I know their language. I think I know their hearts. And they have told me, peace is possible, but only with you Germans." Mirsbach, listening carefully, said, "Let us talk further about this." And when the two men found themselves in harmony on all points, they issued a simple statement. "We think a lasting treaty of peace with the Comanche is possible." Frenzied discussion had followed. Franziska told Otto, with old-time Kentucky settlers warning Mirsbach, "You wasn't here when President Lamar laid down the basic rule for handling Indians in Texas, eviction or extermination." "Ain't no way white men can live aside Indians, because they ain't human like us." "How did Ernst take that?" Otto asked, and she replied, "Shouted in a public meeting, peace is possible." And he volunteered to lead a party out to the Comanche if anyone was brave enough to follow. "Anyone volunteer?" "Mirsbach." "The German nobleman?" And Franza said, "Yes." So that was the way things stood at year's end. Two young men ready for great adventure. Ernst among the Comanche, Otto back in Mexico if the army called. The Mirsbach expedition into the heart of the Comancheria assembled its gear in mid-January 1847. And when Otto realized that these men really were going to plunge into enemy territory, where the risk of death by torture was great, he insisted upon going along with his multiple weapons. But Ernst said, "No, this is a peaceful mission," and Mirsbach agreed. Otto, disgusted by this non-military attempt, warned, "You'll die staked out before a fire, but don't call for the Rangers. It'll be too late." He was considering whether he should, to protect these headstrong Germans, gather a few men like himself and ride discreetly behind the would-be peacemakers, when he heard Franziska call from her kitchen door the single word, "Liebchen." Their affinity through the years of their extraordinary courtship and in the early months of their marriage had become so intuitive that whenever Franza uttered the word "Liebchen" in a certain inflection, her husband knew that she was about to say something of importance. "What?" he asked, turning his whole attention to her. She blushed, hesitated, then said in a low voice, "I'm to have a baby." She said no more, and he refrained from jumping in the air or embracing her fervently. Instead, he bowed to her and she to him, for they were people of silent moments deeply cherished. But the moment of reverence was broken by the arrival of Panther Comex, who bellowed as he approached the cabin, "McNabb, General Taylor needs us at Saltillo. Garner's taking down his best men from Company M." When the bear-like man saw Franziska, he whisked her up in his arms, threw her in the air, and shouted, "How did you ever catch this one, little nubbin?" "Put her down," Otto yelled. And when he saw her safely on the ground, he whispered to Comex, "She's going to have a baby." Panther stepped back, surveyed the couple, and clucked his tongue. "Fraulein McNabb, you are beautiful, simply beautiful." And he gave her a great hairy kiss, which practically covered her face. He was the second man to have kissed her, and she was astonished at his boldness. "Yes," he snorted, as the Ahlerkamp women fed him gargantuan quantities of food. "Messengers came north with news that old Rough and Ready was bulldogging his way into the heart of Mexico, without scouts, with disaster every time he moved. After 6 or 7 routs of his dragoons, here he leaped to his feet and galloped about the place, imitating the American cavalry on their big horses, riding, fat and dumb, right into Mexican ambushes. Hell, he knowed he needed us to do his dirty work. "Can't you stay the night?" Thecla asked. And he said, "Nope, we got to join up with Garner and the others at Laredo." So packing was done hastily. But when Franziska went out to put Otto's gear on his waiting horse, she saw his saddle blanket and uttered a cry. "There's blood on your saddle." And when Panther went to scratch the discoloration, he confirmed, "Yep, it's blood." "Otto, were you wounded?" Franza asked, her face even paler than before. But Panther dissipated her fears. "Your little man never gets wounded. He wounds other people." And the two rangers explained how they had captured those two little mountains at Monterey, Federacion and Independencia, and how on the latter hill, when they attacked the bishop's palace, Ranger Lucas had been killed. "Me and your husband carried his body down and tied it to Otto's saddle," Panther said. And when he saw Franziska blanch, he added, "Hell, ma'am, him and me's been in 12 fights like that. We never get hurt." This mention of death, something the families of rangers rarely discussed, for they appreciated the perils of their men's rough occupation, spurred Franziska to reveal something she had intended never to tell her husband. Now, taking his hand and leading him away from Panther, she whispered, "While you were in Mexico, your friend Yancey Quimper rode into Fredericksburg, seeking to buy land or open a store or anything. Nobody trusted him, so he left. But he stopped by here and asked me many questions. And, Otto, he wanted to know, if you got killed in the war, if he could come speak with me, and..." She hesitated, for she knew that if she revealed the remainder of that incredible visit, Otto might go storming out and kill Quimper. But the realization of death compelled her to speak. "He tried to kiss me. I pushed him away and told him to be gone. He stood in the doorway and said, 'Remember, Franziska, I wanted to marry you before Otto ever saw you. If anything happens—'" Otto said nothing, hands at his side, linen duster about his feet. But his wife added, "He wants you dead, Otto. Please, please take care of yourself." "Time to go," Comax warned. And the two rangers, taking extra horses with them and Otto's arsenal of guns, headed south and overtook Garner and the rest of the company at Laredo. From there, they splashed across the shallow Rio Grande and started the dangerous passage to Saltillo, where General Taylor would be encamped, awaiting the arrival of Santa Anna with the main Mexican army. "Any danger of Mexican raiding parties?" Otto asked, and Garner replied, "There's always danger, as long as Benito Garza is alive, and especially when Taylor's army hasn't been keeping scouts on the perimeters." Each day Otto served with this gangling man, he respected his abilities more. Garner was certainly not a compelling figure, and he lacked the fiery oratory of a dashing leader. But in all he did, he was completely sensible, a man who seemed to anticipate the flow of battle with an acute awareness of where he and his troops could be used with maximum effect. Panther once said, 20 of us rangers with Garner at our head is equal to 40. Out in him, we're just 20. Garner demonstrated his professionalism shortly after his contingent completed its furtive crossing of the northern desert on the 4th of February, 1847, and reported to Lieutenant Colonel Cobb, who, as before, would serve as their superior. The fastidious South Carolinian, watching them straggle in, a disjointed file with men and horses in every conceivable condition, winced at the ugly prospect of dealing with them through another campaign. But he did take Captain Garner in to see General Taylor, who proved to be as gruff as ever. "Bad situation. We know Santa Anna's coming north. But where, and when, and how many, that we don't know." "And it's our job to find out?" Garner asked without bravado. "That's why I sent for you." The general hesitated, then decided to be frank. I was damned glad to see you go, Garner. Never seen a rowdier group of soldiers. Can't you instill any discipline? Before the lanky captain could respond, Taylor added, And I'm damned glad to have you back. He wanted to shake Garner's hand, or even embrace him in a soldierly way, but instead he said gruffly, Everything hangs on the next few days. Find out what they're up to. Garner decided to take 8 Rangers with him on a protracted scout of the southern approaches to Saltillo. And as his men gathered in that beautiful cathedral square, where the Frenchman René Claude d'Ambreuse had courted Trinidad de Saldana, he knew their task was a dangerous one. For if discovered on this foray, they might have to fight large forces of Mexican lancers. But the Rangers were skilled in clandestine operations, and if a solitary Ranger was suddenly cut off from his fellows, he would know that he must proceed alone. He could be counted upon to sneak his way back to headquarters with a reliable report of how things stood in the areas he had seen. And if only that one Ranger survived to deliver essential information regarding the forthcoming battle, the scout would be judged a success. When Garner's men left Saltillo, they entered almost immediately upon a terrain that seemed as if it had been carved out of rock by the god of battles for some special Armageddon. It was a narrow defile, lined on the east by mountains so high they could not be scaled. Their lower reaches, however, provided a sloping field across which cavalry could charge. The west flank consisted of a deep gully backed by lower hills. Here, cavalry could not function, but foot soldiers could. General Taylor, marching south into the defile, would have to smash head-on into General Santa Anna marching north, and the outcome would depend upon how skillfully each general utilized the sloping hills to the east and those gaping gullies to the west. "This ain't gonna be easy," Panther told Otto as they studied the brutal terrain. When Otto made no reply, for none would have been relevant, Panther added, "But I guess you fight your battles where they happen." And again Otto said nothing, for he was studying those ominous slopes to the east, wondering how his Rangers would utilize them if an attack by Santa Anna's lancers suddenly developed. On the 20th of February, 1847, Garner and his men reconnoitered the oncoming Mexican army. And as brave as the Rangers were, they were shaken when they got to the crest of a hill and saw the endless manpower that Santa Anna was bringing north. Panther called back to those still climbing below, "Damned lines go on forever." "Can you spot the camp they'll be using tonight?" Cobb asked, cupping his hands to muffle his voice. "Off to one side," Comex replied, lowering his voice too. And then he tossed in a typical Ranger addition. "We can reach it tonight." When the huge fellow clambered down, Garner asked, "Panther, can you and 3 men ride ahead and create a diversion? Allow them to chase you back this way without getting caught?" "Don't mind if I do get caught. We can handle them." "Panther, you're not to get caught. You're to tease them on. Because me and McNabb, we're going to go right into the heart of their camp, and we want them to be chasing you, not us." Otto displayed not the slightest emotion. He dismounted, took off his white duster, folded it meticulously, and handed it for safekeeping to one of the 2 Rangers who would not be involved in either foray. This done, he hitched up his trousers, felt for his 2 Colts, stowed his 2 old pistols in his saddle, and climbed back on his horse. Together with Garner, he started the perilous, tortuous advance to the Mexican lines. They rode through the scattered advance posts, boldly keeping to their horses. Disguised as Mexicans, with Garner wearing a colorful serape, they rode straight into a position at which they could dismount, tethered their horses, and moved cautiously about, noting strengths and dispositions. For a day, 26 hours, they remained inside enemy lines, one sleeping while the other watched. And in the early part of the night, when the Mexicans were careless and talkative, they crept very close to the tents, and it was in the moon-cast shadow of one of these that McNabb saw a Mexican officer bending over to tighten the guy ropes. As he did so, Otto realized that it was Benito Garza, not 15 yards away. "Captain," he whispered, "that's Garza, I'm sure. I'm going in and kill him." Garner restrained him. Any noise would be fatal. "But he's the brains in the strip." "I know who he is," Garner snapped, "and I know that any motion now..." Now McNabb experienced agonies of indecision. There was Garza, an enemy he was obligated to kill, almost within touching distance. Behind was the American army needing information. It was Garner who solved this dilemma. "If he's that important to you, Otto, break in and shoot him. You'll not get out alive, but..." "Give me 15 minutes lead, and I'll be safe." "It is that important," McNabb said. "So be it," Garner said. But before he could return to his tethered horse, someone else left the tent to catch a breath of clean night air. And the watchers saw that it was a woman, a young woman of great charm and obvious breeding. She was, it seemed likely, the wife of some officer, and her presence deterred McNabb's plan of bursting in with pistols blazing. Garner grasped him by the arm, as if to pull him away. But then Garza reappeared and placed his arm about the woman's waist and kissed her. Who could the woman be? She seemed no more than 20, and Garza must be at least 40. But that they were in love, there could be no doubt, none whatever. "Has he a wife?" Garner asked. "Who knows?" Otto replied. And quietly the two rangers retreated. They slept about 100 yards from their horses, Garner spreading his serape on the ground for both of them. And when the sun was well up, they mounted their steeds, walked them quietly north, saluted sentries as if on an inspection tour, and when they saw a break in the lines, galloped like terrified ghosts, neither shouting nor looking back at the men who were firing the bullets that whistled past their heads. When they reported to General Taylor, he was awed by their adventure and dismayed by the estimates they gave of Santa Anna's strength. "We must draw back," he said. "If we stay, we're trapped." He thanked Garner for his daring and turned to do the same for McNabb, but the little ranger was gone. "Where is he?" Taylor asked. And Garner pointed to where Otto was retrieving his duster from its custodian. Shaking it out and slapping away any dust, he slipped it about his shoulders and considered himself ready for the impending battle. Benito Garza, commanding General Santa Anna's scouts, was not informed of the infiltration of the Mexicano lines by American spies. The sentries who had fired at Garner and McNabb were afraid to report the sortie, lest they be shot for having allowed it to happen. He remained in his tent with his wife, Lucha Lopez, and with the regular army officers with whom he worked. This was the 21st of February, 1847, a cold, damp day. And because the two armies had moved so near to each other, it was obvious that battle could not be avoided, with visible advantage to the Mexicanos. Garza was especially hopeful. "This time, Lucha, we annihilate them." He spent the morning making arrangements for her to move far to the rear, to be with the other women who had accompanied their men. But at noon, he was alerted by reports from his scouts. "General Taylor is retreating." Kissing Lucha, he rode out to check this surprising development and found that the news was accurate. The Americans were withdrawing, and rather precipitately. But he was not deceived by their tactic. They're seeking more favorable ground, and they're right. Nevertheless, he had reason to be hopeful about this battle, for Santa Anna, blustering across Mexico, a wooden leg in one stirrup, had performed his customary miracle of assembling a huge number of men and forging them into a respectable army. He had at his disposal, of course, a reliable cadre of young, able, and dedicated officers like Benito Garza, none better in all the armies of the world, and on them he relied to stiffen the ranks. He was also supported by a fierce patriotism which invariably rallied whenever Spanish or French or especially American enemies threatened. But most important, he still retained that tremendous charisma which designated him a true romantic hero and which bound men like Garza to him with unbreakable bonds. Santa Anna in the saddle again. A thrill ran through the nation. Santa Anna was in command of the army again. Men marched with more vigor. Lancers rode with more elan. Santa Anna was heading back to avenge his unlucky defeat at San Jacinto, to repeat his earlier triumphs at the Alamo and Goliad. Tejas would be regained. New Mexico and California would be saved. As the sun set, almost every man in the Mexicano army believed that on the morrow Santa Anna would celebrate his birthday with another stupendous victory. He almost did. In fact, he should have. Not on the 22nd, which was more or less a stalemate, with the Americans suffering major casualties and a loss of valuable position, but on the 23rd, when the 3-1 Mexican superiority in numbers and mobility began to tell. About mid-morning, the attack along the foothills of the eastern mountains, the attack which Garner and his men had known to be inevitable, began, with a furious charge by several companies of elite lancers supported by rapid-firing dragoons. Ashen-faced, General Taylor observed, "They're turning our left flank." Perceiving that if they did, the superb Mexican cavalry would chop up his rear echelons and throw the entire American army into rout, he called for all available men to stanch the blood being let by the lancers, and under his stalwart leadership, a few cavalry and many foot soldiers assembled to halt the surging Mexican horsemen. Old Rough and Ready may have been slow-witted, but he was no fool. Never first-rate in overall strategy, when engaged in a specific battle, he knew where to throw his strength at critical moments. And now he dug in, a stubborn man fighting his last encounter. With appalling power and skill, the Mexicans hammered at his left flank. But like a wounded bear, Taylor growled and gathered power and fought back. At the critical moment, when the battle seemed lost, he called upon a Mississippi gentleman whom he had once despised to save the day. 12 years before, Colonel Jefferson Davis, then age 27, had eloped with Taylor's daughter Sarah, an act that still rankled the general. But now, Taylor had to swallow his pride and call upon Davis and his Mississippi Rifles to hold off Santa Anna's rampaging cavalry, and with support from the Texas Rangers, Davis led his troops in a gallant charge. The Rangers were led by Percifer Cobb, braver almost than they, who relished the chance to gallop his horse right at the Mexican lancers and test his skill against theirs. Cobb was supported, he was relieved to note, by Garner and Comax on his left and Otto McNabb on his right, the latter firing his pistols like a little arsenal. Together, they simply rode down the Mexicans, who had smaller steeds and inferior firepower. "Watch the lances," Cobb shouted, as he knocked down a lancer about to pierce McNabb, who raised his Colts in a salute as he roared past in pursuit of his own targets. When General Taylor saw that the day had been saved, he had the grace to say to his son-in-law, "Colonel Davis, my daughter was a better judge of men than I was." But none of the Americans believed this battle to have been a victory, not by any means. Losses were great. Valuable positions had once more been wrested away by superior Mexican numbers and performance. Indeed, as night fell, General Taylor had to consider the likelihood that on the morrow he was doomed to suffer a crushing defeat. And with this mournful prospect staring at him, he assembled his officers. "Can we hold them if they make a dawn attack?" he asked. "Our men and horses are exhausted. But can they make one last effort?" "They can always make an effort, but..." Throughout the night the discussions continued, and at 1 o'clock or thereabouts, Taylor suggested that his best Texas scouts be sent out to bring news of exactly when the Mexicans would begin their major attack. Lieutenant Colonel Cobb thought the general had tears in his eyes as he said, "Give us what help you can, Percifer. I knew your Uncle Leander. Good man with horses, that one." Despite Captain Garner's urgent suggestion that Cobb remain safe with General Taylor, the South Carolinian insisted upon sharing the scout with his Texans, and they went alarmingly deep into enemy territory. 2 o'clock, and only sporadic signs of enemy action. 3 o'clock, and still darkest winter night, with Mexican troops huddling to keep warm. 4 o'clock, and only that ominous silence. 5 o'clock, and just a faint show of light from a campfire visible here and there. At 6, when dawn would betray their presence, the Rangers were in maximum danger, and Cobb, aware of this, cautioned additional care. But Panther Comex ignored his warnings, rose boldly in his saddle, stared ahead in disbelief, and shouted, "Jesus Christ!" When the others rode up, several of them repeated Panther's cry, "Jesus Christ!" On the evening after the great battle at Buena Vista, when the Mexicans had stood within 6 inches or 6 minutes of an astounding victory, General Santa Anna had convened a meeting of his officers. And such is the strangeness of battle that approximately identical questions were being asked. "Can we crush them in the morning?" the one-legged Napoleon asked. "Our lancers, all our cavalry, they did what they could this afternoon." "Can they repeat?" Silence. No one dared tell the dictator of Mexico, the commander-in-chief, the Benemérito de la Patria, El Supremo, that something was impossible. But it was clear, even to him, that the Mexicano cavalry had shot its bolt. It had been a gallant bolt, one of the best, but it was finished. The infantry? More silence. No other infantry in the world suffered the disadvantages that were the common lot of the peasants who formed the bulk of any Santa Anna army. Conscripted at gunpoint, they marched barefoot, clad only in thin cotton shirts, even in the dead of winter, like now. And they bled and shivered and died of dysentery, for their army provided no field hospitals to accompany them and no medicines to soften the dreadful fevers they contracted. Despite these deprivations and the lack of food, they were obedient and brave, and when they started running at an enemy line, they usually breached it. Such soldiers had defeated Spaniards, Frenchmen, Americans, and other Mexicans, and if ordered on the morrow to attack the weakened American lines, they would do so until their bodies piled higher than a small tree. But their officers stood silent, for they knew that, because of supply problems, those faithful soldiers shivering in the wintry blast had eaten nothing for nearly 30 hours. They would obey orders and start toward the Norte Americano lines tomorrow, that was certain. But they might well collapse before they got there, and not necessarily from enemy gunfire. To the surprise of everyone in his tent, Santa Anna changed the course of his discussion and said most abruptly, "We had a great victory today, did we not?" "Yes, General." "And we overran 6 or 7 headquarters positions, did we not?" "We did." "Did we capture many enemy flags?" "We did. Cortés alone has 7. I saw them." "Let Cortés speak for himself." The gallant lancer was sent for, and Santa Anna asked, "Did you capture enemy flags?"
"Yes, General, 7.
"Any other trophies?"
"Many, many."
Santa Anna now turned to the one man he knew he could trust in any adversity, a man who had always given straight answers. "Garza, can we defeat them tomorrow?"
"Unquestionably."
"Why do you say that, when these others—"
"Because I know what's going on over there."
He pointed north toward Saltillo and the American lines. "They're holding a meeting like this, and they know they've been defeated."
"Will they retreat, do you think?"
Now Garza had to pause, for in his careful study of the Norte Americanos, he had perceived that Zachary Taylor was not the clever kind of general who saw things in big design. He was a man who took a position and held on to it until he was knocked off.
"Retreat?" Garza said slowly. "Maybe not, but—"
Santa Anna had heard enough. On the very threshold of a victory which would have enshrined him in the bosom of Mexico forever, he gave his order. "Immediately, we march back to Potosí."
"Excellency," Garza protested,
but the fatal die had been cast. "Strike camp,
Abandon everything not instantly needed and march before dawn.
When Garza dashed to the tent where his wife was sleeping, he wakened her roughly. "It's ended, Lucha. Back to Potosí."
"Oh, no," she cried, for she saw in the resumed battle a chance of victory for her beliefs.
"It's the end for Santa Ana," Garza said with great sadness. And when his wife, packing furiously, asked what he meant, he explained prophetically, "Another Norte Americano army will land at Veracruz. They'll march to Puebla and surround Mexico City. Defeat. Defeat. They'll depose Santa Ana, and then they'll go home thinking it's all over." He interrupted Lucha's packing and took her by the hands. "But for us, it will never be over. If they want to steal that land south of the Nueces, they better be prepared to pay in blood." It was this flight south that dawn that had so astonished Panther Comex and his fellow rangers. On the day that General Taylor realized he had won the battle at Buena Vista, if one did not inspect the facts too closely, he agreed to let the Texans disband and go home. He explained to Garner that, although he appreciated their contributions, none more valiant, he could not endanger the security of his army by allowing them to harass guiltless Mexican citizens and expose the regular army to guerrilla action in retaliation. "You must leave at once, and try not to arouse the countryside by thoughtless killings as you go." In the morning, Taylor said goodbye to the Rangers. "I thank you for your gallant efforts, but before you depart, I want you to hear the summary prepared by Colonel Cobb." Whereupon the South Carolinian, in his trimmest uniform, stepped forward to read a report he had compiled. While it is conceded by all that the Texas Rangers have performed satisfactorily all military tasks assigned them, there have unfortunately been certain deficiencies in discipline, the consequences of which I shall now summarize. General riots pitting volunteers against regulars, 5. Ordinary courts-martial, 119. General courts-martial, 11. Murders, 4. Murders of Mexican citizens, 84. Attempted murder, 11. Insubordination and mutinous acts, 61. Cowardice in the face of the enemy, 9. At this, several rangers cried, "No, no," but the charges continued. Desertion, 17. Discharged by the commanding general because of general worthlessness, 19. Discharged because of suspicion of insanity, no other charge appearing to be reasonable, 11. The ranger known as Panther Comex, who started the riot last night, which caused at least $600 worth of damage to government property, and who told a superior to go to hell, was subjected last night to a legally convened court-martial whose judgment is hereby delivered. The Texas Ranger Leroy Comex, known as Panther, shall receive a dishonorable discharge and shall hear the rogue's march. Panther stood rigid, but many rangers, including Captain Garner, shouted, "No, no!" For there was no greater disgrace in the armed services than for a man to stand at his final attention as the band started to sound the miserable notes of the rogue's march, and then to march goose-stepping out of the company while some stout sergeant jerked high the seat of his pants. 4 burly sergeants surrounded Panther and brought him to face the band, which launched immediately into that doleful, insulting lament for things gone wrong. As soon as the first note sounded, a 5th sergeant, bigger than the others, grabbed Panther by the seat and started marching him off the parade ground. Never again could such a disgraced man serve with the regular army, and Panther should have gone in silence, accepting his punishment. But at the edge of the field, as he was about to be shoved off, he turned and challenged the Army of Northern Mexico. "Give me 6 good rangers, and we'll knock the shit out of your whole force." When he was removed, Percifer Cobb returned stiffly to the reading of the citation. "Acts of bravery unnumbered. Devotion to duty unparalleled. Patriotism unquestioned." He paused.
Rangers of Texas, you are unforgettable.
With that, both he and General Taylor snapped to attention and saluted. Often during these hectic days of the Mexican War, Otto worried about what was happening to Ernst Ahlerkamp on his foray into the Comancheria, and on the way back to Texas, he told Comex, who seemed undisturbed by his rude dismissal from military service, "I'll bet those men who went out among the Indians had it a lot rougher than we did." And as soon as he reached his home and satisfied himself that Franziska was in good health, he asked, "And what happened to Ernst?" In response, she rang the bell which the Ahlerkamp women used for signaling their men. Too short, too long for Ernst. And in a moment he came from the fields, delighted to see his brother-in-law. In self-effacing words, he summarized a remarkable event. 3 days after you left for Mexico, Herr Merzbach started his expedition for the Comancheria, and I was able to lead him to the principal chiefs. I translated, you know, and we conducted long talks, for the Indians like to go over everything many times. But during hours when I wasn't working, I made friends with a young Comanche warrior. Blonde hair, pale complexion, he was surely a white man. At first he would explain nothing, but when I gave him tobacco, he wanted to talk. "My name is Thomas Lyons. I lived near Austin. The Comanche came to our farm and murdered my parents, took me away with them. I like being an Indian and do not care to go back to Austin, where my brother lives." I could understand this. As a boy, I wanted to be an Indian. But what shocked me was the answer I got when I asked, "Who is this little Mexican boy who follows you about?" And Thomas Lyons said, "I captured him during one of our raids on the Rio Grande." And when I suggested that I take the boy with me and return him to his parents, Lyons asked, "Why?" Ernst fell silent, still disturbed by the fact that Indians, too, had slaves. And after a while, Otto asked, "What happened with the Comanche?" And Ernst explained how Merzbach, with skill and patience, had engineered a compassionate treaty which was to be ratified in Fredericksburg within 2 weeks. Otto was alarmed. "Ernst, the Comanche never honor a treaty." And in the days that followed, while Ernst rode out to lead the great chiefs of that tribe in for the signing, Otto moved through Fredericksburg, repeating his softly stated warning. "I'm a ranger. I've fought Indians and Mexicans alike. They're both no good. No place in Texas for either of them." For 3 days, as Ernst and the chieftains approached from the west, Otto strove to discredit the treaty, and he might have continued had not Franziska intervened. "Otto, there's a new day, new rules. Ernst is right. It's time for peace." McNab was so startled to hear a woman oppose him, a dutiful German housewife, that he stood agape. He looked at her, small, tense, her hair in braids as if she were still a young girl, and to his own amazement he dropped the argument. Taking her in his arms, he whispered, "I came home to build us a real house, our home. If Ernst's treaty makes it possible, I'm all for it." He kissed her twice, then added, "But when those Indians come into our town, I'm going to be watching, very careful." On a lovely May morning, the Comanche arrived, fearful Indians on sleek ponies. Remembering well the tragedy their brothers had encountered during such a meeting in San Antonio, they insisted upon a safeguard, which Ernst interpreted. "They will lay down their weapons, all of them, even their daggers, in the middle of the roadway, if we Germans would do the same." Merzbach pleaded with the townsmen to accept these terms, and when, against Otto's advice, the pile was made, 2 Indian braves and McNab were assigned to watch it. Otto had wanted to be inside the hotel to safeguard the meeting, but Merzbach had outsmarted him, so there he sat in the warm May sunlight, guarding the weapons and noticing where his Colt's 5-shooters lay in case he had to grab them in a hurry.
He noticed also that the two braves were marking the location of their weapons in case of crisis. He judged that he could out-grab and out-shoot them. Next, he studied how, having gunned down the two guardians, he could whip about and aim his fire at the entrance to the Nimitz house to shoot the parleying chiefs if they attempted to join the fray. But the tragedy of San Antonio was not repeated, because John Mirsbach, supported by Ernst Ahlerkamp, had convinced both the Comanche and the Germans that this little paradise set down among the hills, this land of tumbling fields and flowing streams, this Eden of bluebonnets and Indian paintbrush, was indeed different, and that amidst the gunfire that echoed across Texas, here stood a refuge of sanity. The treaty was agreed upon. Braves and Germans recovered their weapons. McNabb, as he picked up his revolvers, muttered to himself, "Be on watch when the next Comanche moon rides the sky." He wanted peace as much as anyone in Fredericksburg, but he would continue to prepare for war. At Easter, as he had predicted, the Comanche came sneaking back, and on a night as calm and lovely as the hill country had known, they crept toward the sleeping town. Otto McNabb, always on guard, saw them first, terrifying figures on the silvery horizon. And running for his guns, he shouted, "Franze, quick, bring the extra powder." But Ernst stopped him, pointing to the surrounding hills. And there, in the brightness of the Easter moon, the Indians had lighted signal fires, scores of them, on all perimeters, signaling the Germans that, in these valleys at least, peace prevailed, now and in the future. Otto was amazed. With Franze beside him, he laid down his guns to watch the fires. But Ernst did not look. Uncas had lowered his head, and he was weeping. When General Zachary Taylor failed to crush the Mexican army in his questionable victory at Buena Vista, General Winfield Scott was given the job of disembarking at Veracruz and finishing the job in the vicinity of Mexico City. But with an army of only 10,000 American troops to subdue millions of Mexicans on their home ground, he was forced to take draconian steps. When guerrillas struck at his supply lines, secretly at night and outside the rules of what he called organized warfare, he issued a startling set of orders, summarized in these words: "No quarter will be extended to murderers, robbers, or any man out of uniform who attacks our convoys. They are equally dangerous to Mexicans, foreigners, and American troops, and they shall be exterminated. But you are to observe certain rules. Your prisoners are not to be put to death without due solemnity. That is, there shall be no killing of prisoners. What you must do is arrest them, hold them momentarily as prisoners, convene a hearing, sentence them on the spot, and then shoot them." Therefore, the Americans who had protested so vigorously the savage actions of General Santa Anna at the Alamo and Goliad were now going to operate under almost the same rules. Scott's second action was perhaps the more significant, for in order to have at his command men prepared to act with such severity, he asked the army to call back into service as many Texas Rangers as possible. And in compliance with this summons, Captain Sam Garner, in retirement on his farm, agreed to reassemble his Company M, if he could have with him Otto McNabb and Panther Comax. Garner had no trouble signing up the Panther. "I'd rather fight greasers than eat." But after the captain had spent 2 days with the McNabbs, he knew that Otto was completely absorbed in his son Hamish and not at all disposed to return to Mexico. "Look, I got me a son. I want to stay here and help Franziska with the place. You know, Captain Garner, it really is something for a man to have a son. Can you imagine a tiny little hand like that, he can't even keep it straight, holding a Colt's one of these days?" Garner was finding it difficult to believe that Otto, deadliest of his Rangers, could be so domesticated. So on the third day at breakfast, he turned to Mrs. McNabb. "Franze, I want to take your man with me again." And she agreed. "I think he's ready to go now. Be careful, all of you." When the company assembled, Otto was surprised to see Panther in the ranks. "How can you go back after they gave you that rogue's march in Saltillo?" The big man brushed aside such apprehension. "That was up north. Scott's down south." And when Otto reminded him that armies keep records, he said, "They do, that they do. Come peace, they don't want bastards like me. But come war, and Scott has plenty of that. They're glad to have us."
"Aren't you afraid your record will follow you?" Otto asked. And Panther replied, "And when Scott sees it, he's going to shout, 'That's just the son of a bitch I want. He may even make me an officer.'"
When their warship delivered them to the steaming port of Veracruz, the rangers lining the rail of the tender that brought them ashore let out a wild yell of joy. For awaiting them stood the austere, primly dressed figure of their old commander, Percifer Cobb, breveted to full colonel for his bravery. "We're back," Comac shouted exuberantly. And when the South Carolinian realized that this incorrigible was being returned to his command, he blanched. "Oh, no," he cried to no one. "That I will not tolerate." But when the reunion was completed, Colonel Cobb outlined the Rangers' new mission. "We're trying to do what no major army in recent history has ever attempted, so far as I know. With only a handful of men, cut off from reinforcements, we're trying to conquer and pacify an entire nation. We're Hernando Cortez in the 19th century, and we're in just as much danger." He traced the perilous route to the capital. "Guerrilleros molest every column we send over these hills. Our job is to stop them, to exterminate them, without quarter." Stern disciplinarian that he was, Percifer Cobb took pride in being as strict with himself as with his underlings. So he firmed his jaw and tried once more to bring some sort of order to the Texans. But he failed. Despite orders, the Rangers drank whatever water they pleased, and soon they were stricken with violent cases of dysentery, which immobilized them for about a week. They were too sick to stand, let alone march. And even when the tougher men like McNabb and Comax revived, they found that their captain remained terribly sick, not only with dysentery, but also with the more threatening El Vomito. Practiced hands advised Colonel Cobb to send Garner back to a homeward-bound ship. But the fighting ranger would not allow this, so on a litter he made the painful progress to the upland town of Jalapa. In that beautiful spot, where the rigors of Veracruz vanished amid flowers, beautiful homes, and literally acres of fresh fruit and fields full of cattle, Garner recovered. And it was believed later that had he been in full health, and therefore better able to command his men, the tragedy at Avila might not have happened. But Colonel Cobb did not agree. All Texans are murderers whenever a Mexican is involved, and had Captain Garner been his usual self, I'm sure he would have led the disgraceful affair. La Desolación de Avila, they called it in the steamy rainforests leading to the Altiplano, and it was the result of the daring action of the guerrilla leader Benito Garza, who waited in the jungle until Captain Garner's detachment was well strung out, then struck with fury at the vulnerable midpoint. The sudden attack caught the still-weakened Garner unawares, and before his startled men could protect him, he was impaled by three swords. Summoning all his frail strength, he straightened in the saddle, tried to catch up with his men, then toppled forward over his horse's neck. His men, seeing him fall, lashed out at any Mexican they could find, and in their blind rage came upon the innocent village of Avila, in which one of Garza's men had taken refuge. Galloping into the central plaza, they began shooting any Mexicans they saw, whereupon the guerrilla took aim and struck the man riding next to Comex square in the forehead, dropping him like a bird. He did not bleed profusely, but the bullet hole was so conspicuous on his fever-blanched skin that every ranger who leaped over his dead body could see it. No person inside the sniper's hiding place survived the ranger's revenge, not even the three children. Methodically, the Texans then swept through the half-dozen adobes that lined the square. And by evil luck, Comex and McNabb found themselves dashing from the last house directly at the open door of the village church. Without stopping, they burst into the church, killed three old men who had taken refuge there, and proceeded to wreck the place, scattering holy implements here and there in the roadway outside. As they withdrew, they killed six cows in a final surge of fury. When a great outcry arose from Avila and surrounding towns, with the bishop himself protesting, Colonel Cobb summoned his offending rangers. "We were fired on by irregulars," Comex explained. "Is that true, McNabb?" Cobb asked. "From the house with the brown door." "Were guerrillas found inside? When you finished, that is?"
"There were," McNabb said.
"What about the church?" Cobb asked. "The desecration of the church?"
"Three guerrillas ran in there," Comex said.
"Did you see them run in?" Cobb asked McNabb.
"I did."
"And what did you do?" Cobb asked.
"I stood guard in the street. I figured Panther and his men, they could handle it."
"Did you see the guerrillas, you yourself?"
"Twice. When they ran in, when they were dead."
Colonel Cobb turned to the bishop and the other protesters. "Gentlemen, I'm sure you have copies of General Scott's orders concerning the suppression of guerrillas. They're to be eliminated, for your safety as well as ours."
"But the children," the bishop pleaded.
"Our men cannot check in advance, at peril to their lives."
"And the church, the holy vestments, the altar?"
"Major Wells will give you a signed statement attesting to the fact that known guerrillas unfortunately ran into the church, and that in pursuit some minor damage proved unavoidable. There will be compensation." Sometime later, after the dead ranger was buried, and the graves of the villagers decked with flowers, and the church restored, Cobb asked Comex and McNabb, "Were there guerrillas in the church?"
"There could have been," said Panther.
Riding with the rangers was a civilian from New York named Harry Saxon, 22 years old, red-headed, and encumbered by an extraordinary amount of gear, which he protected with a horse pistol. At first, Cobb's men thought he must be a medical man, but when Saxon ignored the fallen and trembled whenever he saw blood, they knew that guess was wrong. Finally, Comex, catching the newcomer staring at him offensively, roared, "Son, who in hell are you?"
"Harry Saxon, New York Dispatch."
"Newspaper man?"
"Yep."
"And what is all that stuff?"
"I'm a photographer."
"And what in hell is that?" Patting his gear, he explained, "I make pictures. They're called daguerreotypes." These words were new to the rangers, who crowded about to see the miracle of photography. Unwittingly, Harry Saxon occupied a unique place in world military history. He was taking the first ever photographs of an army engaged in battle, and it was the photograph he took this sunny afternoon, with the desolated buildings of Avila in the background, which made him famous, and which would last as long as men cherished visual records of their exploits. This daguerreotype, remarkably clear and evocative, showed the ruined church, a tethered donkey, and in the foreground, two savage, scowling Texas Rangers. A towering Panther Comex, bearded, unkempt, with his coonskin over his left ear, and a small, smooth-faced Otto McNabb, linen duster covering his toes, and a hardened stare which warned, "Don't touch me." It was a summarizing picture of the newly fledged Texas state at war, seeking revenge for past insults, and to look at its subjects was to share their seething rage. But it was Saxon's written account of how the victorious Texans entered Mexico City in their crusade of pacification that was of the greater significance to the new state. Unfamiliar with the insolent behavior of rangers, he could not comprehend what he had witnessed, and when wood engravers in New York translated his word pictures into newspaper illustrations, citizens across the nation asked, also in disbelief, "My God, is that Texas? Have we taken men like that into our Union?" Hearing that the Texans were about to approach the capital, I left Mexico City and rode east toward the little village of Avila, hoping to intercept them as they came up out of the jungle. I arrived on a fateful morning,
and had breakfast with their captain, Sam Garner, a scarecrow, gaunt from prolonged dysentery, who told me, "We teach them that you can't stop a man who knows he's right and keeps coming, especially if he has two Colts 44 and you don't." An hour later, weakened Captain Garner was killed by a Mexican guerrilla. Deprived of their captain, the Rangers were in an ugly mood when we entered Mexico City this morning, but no one could have guessed how they would express their rage. At the outskirts of the capital, a big, hairy ranger called Panther Comax shouted in a loud voice, "Men, let's remind these B-S who's in charge." I supposed they were going to gallop in, firing their Colts. But no, they had a true Texan gesture up their sleeves, one that I could never have imagined. What they did was clothe themselves in their most outrageous garments, no two alike, fluff out their beards, stow their Colts so they were always visible, don their big hats, and then take every imaginable position astride their horses, some riding fallen forward as if asleep, others facing sideways and ignoring their horses as they glared at the Mexicans crowding the sides of the streets. 8 or 9, including Panther with red flowers in his hair, sat backwards, facing the tails of their horses and looking very serious, as if that was the way they always rode. No ranger spoke. They just came into the city, announcing with their brazen behavior that they were now in Mexico City and that the town was under their control. Los Tejanos Sangrientes, the local people who have heard of their exploits call them. And one incident during the entry gave support to this name. A daring pickpocket, believing backward riding Panther to be asleep, which he feigned to be, deftly reached up and filched the colorful handkerchief that some rangers wear about their necks. Without making any protest, or even moving unusually, Panther unlimbered his Colts, shot the thief in the back, rode over, leaned way down, recovered his neckerchief, retied it about his throat, and rode on. Believe me, the streets cleared. The Texans were in town. Colonel Cobb did not write his brother about the dreadful incident of the 13th of February, 1848. Nor did Harry Saxon report it to New York, for it was too disgraceful to record. Indeed, it was later characterized as one of the least explicable of American military exploits. On that afternoon, a gang of knife-wielding thieves caught a ranger named Adam Alsons alone in an unsavory corner of the city. He apparently did nothing to provoke them, and even when they began to assault him, he allowed them to have his neckerchief and his hat, for he realized that he could not fight his way clear from so large a mob. Encouraged by their initial success, they began to stab at him so viciously that he fell to the street, almost dead. When Otto McNabb and two others came to his rescue, they found him in pitiful shape, one deep cut across his chest having exposed his heart, which beat visibly while they carried his failing body to headquarters. 18 or 19 rangers watched him die. They actually saw his heart begin to falter and then stop. At supper that night, McNabb had to leave the table. Toward 10 the next night, when the streets of the capital were crowded, Panther Comax began quietly circulating among the rangers. And with no one speaking or making any kind of commitment, men like McNabb, acting individually, started leaving the mess hall. A short time later, Harry Saxon entered the hall and asked, "Where's everyone?" But no one offered a sensible answer. He therefore reported to Colonel Cobb, "I think something's amiss. Your men were extremely silent at supper." "They feel the loss of Olson's," Cobb said, offering Saxon both a cigar and a shot of whiskey. The two men were talking amiably about the favorable terms of the peace treaty, when Saxon thought he heard distant gunfire. "Could that be any of your men firing?" "Certainly not," Cobb said warily. "They would not be firing at night." At about 11, the firing increased in volume and sound, and now Saxon cried, "That could come only from Colts." But Cobb assured him, "It's that company of horse marines practicing." "Why would they practice at night?" "You never know." But now the firing drew so close that any military man would have to know it came from repeating revolvers, and both Cobb and Saxon ran out into the night. But at this point the shooting had stopped. At breakfast, no ranger said anything about the night firing. But at about mid-morning, Harry Saxon visited the Mexican police, who showed him the wooden litters on which it was their custom to collect dead bodies found in alleyways at dawn, and on a dozen of them were piled some 50 corpses. When Saxon inquired what had happened, an officer explained. The rangers took their revenge, and 53 bodies were counted out for him. Pimps, pickpockets, paid murderers, scoundrels, plain citizens, all shot at random. And some had apparently taken 3 or 4 shots right in the face, for the big Colt's bullets had blown their heads apart. All day, Saxon tried to piece together what had happened, but no one would tell him that a band of some dozen rangers, led by Panther Comax, had roamed quietly through the back alleyways of the city, through the slums and the red light districts, and had carefully executed anyone who even looked as if he might have wielded a knife on Adam Elson's. In the late afternoon, Saxon went to the morgue, where he saw an additional 80 dead Mexicans, and he noticed that in the capital the rangers were molested no more. Photographer Harry Saxon took 2 more daguerreotypes of historic interest. One showed 3 fighting men, unposed and beautifully positioned against the background of Popocatépetl, Colonel Cobb, stiff, proper, in his most imposing uniform, talking with Comax and McNabb, who were dressed like a pair of complete degenerates. The other picture was more carefully posed, for it had been taken only after sustained negotiation. It depicted the leadership of the Mexican side, General Antonio López de Santa Anna, in full regalia, with at least 8 big medals, accompanied by his guerrilla leader, Benito Garza, jungle thin and glaring behind his huge mustaches. The text that Saxon submitted to accompany his 2 splendid pictures explained how they were related and summarized the ending of this strange war. Your correspondent was privileged to participate in the final stages of the Mexican War. Hearing that General Santa Anna, a major cause of the war and a principal agent of its loss, was being sent into exile in disgrace, I dogged the Mexican headquarters for an opportunity to capture a picture of this colorful man. Returning to the Texas Rangers, whom I had accompanied in their campaign against the guerrillas, I found their leader and 2 of their most colorful members in deep conversation, and I took a chance that they would remain relatively stationary and allow me to use my camera. They did, but at the same time they talked loud enough for me to hear their conversation, which I report faithfully. Cobb, it's true. Santa Anna passes through our lines tomorrow at 8. Comax, let's shoot him. Cobb, none of that. He has a safe conduct from General Scott. Comax, Santiani is a butcher. Let's give him a taste of butcherin'. Cobb, McNabb, can you reason with this wild man? Comax, you ain't never drawed a bean out'n a clay pot. You ain't never seen your father speared down in cold blood while he was an honorable prisoner. Cobb, gentlemen of Texas, we've been through a great deal together. Comax, you had me given the rogue's march. Cobb, and I'd do it again tomorrow. But here in the South I've learned what a heroic group of men you are. I have never served with better. I would ride anywhere on earth, up to the face of any cannon. At this point his voice broke, and for almost a minute he stared at the ground. Men, do not sully a splendid reputation. If you assault your defeated enemy— His voice broke again, and angry at himself, he spoke rapidly. Hell, he's your prisoner. He's unarmed. Do you want to be regarded by all the civilized world as lacking in honor? What are you, anyway, a bunch of miserable bastards? Do you really want to befoul the fair name of Texas? Do you want to stand in shame before the world? Comax, we'll think about that. Unable to extract a promise, Cobb drew himself to full height, saluted, and left his men for what I believe was the last time. His final words to McNabb and Comax, which I heard as he passed me, were, Don't be a pair of Texas sons of bitches. He left us, head high, eyes straight ahead, his beautiful uniform without one misplaced seam. It was a bright morning when General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna prepared to ride through the gauntlet of American soldiers. In the open carriage, pulled by four horses and managed by two drivers fore and two uniformed outriders standing aft, the newly wedded general and his child bride would ride, accompanied by Benito Garza and Lucha Lopez. As Garza stepped into the carriage, he blurted out, "Excellency, the heart of Mexico goes with you into exile." Hands clasped about his bejeweled sword to mask their trembling, Santa Anna gave the order, "Forward," then stared straight ahead. Silently, he passed between the double file of rangers, standing less than 5 feet from him on each side. He glanced at none of them, because he knew that they had sworn to kill him, and he could not guess at what signal they would strike. Each ranger looked hard at him. Each conveyed the bitterness of this extraordinary moment. But none looked with more strangled emotions than their liaison colonel, Persifer Cobb. God, let this moment pass. Let them keep their big mouths shut. Otto McNabb stared at Santa Anna as if to engrave the Mexican's features on his memory. Then, turning his head, stiffened with shock when he saw who was sitting opposite the general. It was Benito Garza, and for a long moment the two old friends, the two perpetual adversaries, looked into each other's eyes. Garza's ebony black, McNabb's cerulean blue, and the respect, the hatred, and the confusion glowed. Neither man made a gesture of recognition. For some reason, the carriage hesitated, and the moment of meeting was agonizingly prolonged. Then the carriage moved forward again. Each man kept his head turned toward the other until dust intervened. The war had ended. It was a perplexing war, which few had welcomed except President Polk and the expansionists, and its significance is revealed only when viewed from three aspects. First, it was an inescapable prolongation of the 1836 Texas Revolution. Since Mexican leadership had never accepted the loss of territory resulting from that struggle, and since Mexico had as many superpatriots as Texas, it was inevitable that continued attempts would be made to recapture the lost province. Arrival of United States power put a stop to such plotting. Second, the war was an application of the new slogan of Manifest Destiny. American patriots had looked at the map and proclaimed almost automatically, "We must control this continent from the Atlantic to the Pacific." Texas dreamers could cry, "We must have everything down to the Isthmus of Panama," and frenzied New Englanders could and did shout for the annexation of Canada, even launching abortive military campaigns to achieve that worthy purpose. The successful outcome of the Mexican War meant that the Pacific coast was secured, and a good thing, in terms of geography at least, was accomplished. Third, the war had a powerful psychological effect on the new state of Texas. It was exerted not on Texas itself, for the war really had only a limited influence internally. It was fought primarily by men and officers from the 27 other states in the Union, and it served as a training ground for the greater war between the states of 1861 to 1865, which lurched ever closer. The names of the younger officers who had fought under Taylor and Scott sound like a roll call to military greatness. Robert E. Lee, Ulysses S. Grant, Braxton Bragg, George Gordon Meade, Albert Sidney Johnston, Jubal Early, William Tecumseh Sherman, P.G.T. Beauregard, Joseph E. Johnston, James Longstreet, George B. McClellan, and the two popular heroes, Stonewall Jackson and Fighting Joe Hooker. It also strengthened the American propensity for electing military heroes to the presidency. Four of the American officers in this war attaining that high office: Taylor, Grant, Jefferson Davis, Franklin Pierce, with three others, Scott, Fremont, and McClellan, trying. Three Mexican officers also attained the presidency of their nation, including the ineffable Santa Anna, who would be summoned back from exile to lead his country once more. If the war had little effect in Texas in tangible terms, how was its significance for the state manifested? Thanks to the newspaper stories of reporters like Harry Saxon and the brilliantly colored lithographs of Currier and Ives, the rest of the nation acquired a romantic and often favorable view of their new state. The Texas Ranger became a legendary figure, composed partly of Panther Comax and his undisciplined ways, partly of Otto McNabb and his merciless efficiency. A deluge of lurid penny thrillers recounted the adventures of Davy Crockett, Jim Bowie, and the Texas Rangers. Tall stories were told about life in Texas decades before most people had heard the word cowboy or ever a steer was driven north. Of course, not every soldier who served in Texas returned home singing its praises. One Pennsylvania volunteer said, "If I was ordered back to Texas, I'd cut my throat." A general said later, "If I owned hell and Texas, I would rent out Texas and live in hell." Perhaps Colonel Persifer Cobb of Edisto Island, South Carolina, said it with deepest feeling. "I am often haunted by nightmares. I'm back in Texas, trying to discipline 36 Rangers." The war left one indelible heritage. It intensified the animosity that already existed between Texans and Mexicans. The savage behavior of the Rangers in both the Monterrey area and Mexico City established them nationally as Los Tejanos Sangrientes, and along the Rio Grande as Los Rinches.